Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. Either we get this done, folks, or we're going to be subjugated. And so I have a special guest. As a matter of fact, my producer kind of introduced me to Mike, and this is Mike McKibbins. And Mike, your primary domain is leader.com, but I believe there's quite a few different domains that you have. And so what is your key domain?
Well, leader.com is the corporate domain, but that's been heavily attacked. Okay. So we have several others that we're using to get out the message. One is Americans for Innovation with the number 4.com, and then there is a related site, aimfortruth.org, with
okay.
the number 4.
All right. And so I'll have those posted on my important information page prior to this actually being aired, because this is pre-recorded. But if you would, send me that. And any other links, books, resources, material, all the stuff that we're going to talk about, because I'd like to actually have that available after people hear this so they can go straight up, go, you know, to you. And, you know, let me even just say this, folks, that I've met a lot of people that have really immersed themselves into the facts of the conspiracy theory. And I don't know if anybody's ever said this, but I would probably consider you a subject matter expert on all things of governments, you know, I'll just say malfeasance and you know, their conspiracies, their plans, and all of that. Is that a little bit too much, or I think I'm hitting the nail on the head myself, but...
Well, I don't know what I don't know.
Yeah, there you go.
Terms of other people.
Right.
We have, by necessity, had to dig very deep into what happened in our particular patent infringement case with Facebook. And then as we began to uncover the different layers of the onion, that's when we discovered the very long conspiracy in our world to control our world that is currently attacking our republic.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things is, because you've talked about Facebook and the stealing of your patent, it's interesting that there is this story that Zuckerberg created Facebook while he was in college, and he was using it as a social media platform with all of his so-called friends in their conquest in dating women and so forth. And so I have a great suspicion that there's probably no truth to that.
None at all.
Right. Okay.
No, he was we've discovered through very detailed research that he is a cardboard cutout for this globalist group that were intent on stealing my technology, and they are closely aligned with the not only the Department of Defense in this country, but also the British military, and specifically the Pilgrim Society in London,
right?
And their association with the City of London, in other words, the banks,
right,
the banks
right,
in
right.
London.
Right. And so let me just say this too, folks, if there's things you want to dive into, because the glossing over of this term Pilgrim Society is far deeper and far more important to really dive into. So if you're interested in, you know, having a very myopic conversation on all these different things that Mike is going to touch on, then I think that, you know, just let me know and we will, you know, actually have a special episode, or we'll include that deep dive. But at this point in time, I kind of, and I know we're going to drill into some things, but I want to kind of look at this whole macro view. And And so when did you actually create this patent for this social media platform?
We started inventing in 1997.
Okay.
And by the year 2000, we had the magic aha moment that you often hear inventors talk about. And then it took us another 3 years to actually reduce that to code, actual software code. Uh-huh. And once we had the invention in 2000, we started looking for patent help to protect our intellectual property. And that's when the saga with the pilgrims began.
Okay. Interesting. Okay, so I remember in the late 90s, there were some rudimentary, and I think Ning was an organization that allowed you to kind of create a framework for a social media platform, Ning.com. And so, because I know people that kind of still use that, it's really, really old school stuff. But what you were doing was you were actually creating an opportunity for, I'll just say, for really open dialogue and open discussion on all topics and so forth, allowing, I'll just say, transferring the freedom of the press really to the people. Is that not correct? And what
was your
intent of, you know, creating this platform? Is that what you were looking to do, or was that just one of the bonuses?
That was what we were looking to do. I had worked prior to that in international Christian work and was actually director of a gospel music group that operated out of England. And what I saw in engaging with people all over the world was there was this inability to communicate on a large scale among people of like-minded interests. And so what we looked to do was create a platform that could do that using the emerging internet in a way that would allow anybody on any topic to set up basically a group space and to create the rules for how they were going to exchange their information, and to do so in a way that respected the right to privacy and the right to property based on the Constitution. So ours was definitely focused on being able to do that, because what I saw in my earlier work, I rebuilt AT&T's email system in the mid-90s, and what I could see was there was a strong move within the technology community at a national and international scale to basically spy on everyone. And I specifically worked to develop a platform that would not do that.
Right, right. And actually, I've told my listeners for years about Amazon and how Amazon basically came to the table, or it was some backroom agreement that as they were establishing themselves as a shopping site, that they would provide the CIA with everything that their users were actually able to, what they looked at while they were logged in and what they purchased, all of that was just shared, just openly shared with the CIA. And at the same time, and this begs the question, because I know you've heard of Abel Danger.
Right.
And so were you outed through the Abel Danger data mining that they were doing under Clinton? In other words, do you think that they actually...
I'm not sure what you mean by outed.
Well, so when they were doing all of this data mining out of the Pentagon in the late 90s for looking for, you know, any suspicious activity, you know, a complete violation of our Fourth Amendment rights. But Abel Danger was out there scooping everything up. So if you were out there and you were out in the open, then there's no doubt in my mind that they had to have caught you up in this Abel Danger data mining.
Disconnected.
Yeah, so Abel Danger must be a hot button. That was interesting.
Wow.
So, okay. So let me just continue. Again, Abel Danger was this mechanism. As a matter of fact, Clinton, if you've ever heard of the Bajinka Project or the Bajinka Operation, Operation Bajinka, I think is the actual term. Able Danger actually pulled that out, and there was a brief that actually came over to the White House that says, hey, we found this thing. And, you know, this is a plan for the, I'll just say these Arabs that were going to hijack jets and fly them into, you know, buildings in America. And at that point, you know, Clinton made some margin notes in this one document, Operation Bajinka. It was a single page document. And he wrote in the margins. And as soon as this lieutenant colonel left the office, the document got filed into the, you know, the registry, and Clinton ordered the shutdown of Able Danger. And so during the 9/11 commission, when they were looking, if you remember, Sandy Berger actually went to the archives, grabbed this document, took it home, and this is how they found out that he did this, because they actually subpoenaed that document, and they couldn't find it. They found out that he checked it out, and then he comes with this little smile on his face and says, oh, I accidentally put that in my briefcase, took it home, and instead of confessing that I had classified it home, I just burnt it. And so anyway, so the Able Danger was actually this huge, this was the beginning of just sucking up where, you know, before NSA actually started creating these data warehouses or clouds for all of this data that they're capable of pulling in, conversations and so forth. It was the beginning of this huge intelligence operation within the United States. So anyway, I thought maybe that you were either aware and that was a tip off of how they started going after you with the Pilgrim Society.
In terms of the Clinton administration, that was when a lot of this energy was surrounding the FBI getting a backdoor key to all internet transactions. But if you actually look at the larger picture historically, the first time that the American intelligence community started spying on Americans was in the mid to late 70s, and it was the Project Echelon. And Edward Snowden exposed that. And that was when a decision was made by a brigadier general by the name of James Freeze to start spying on Americans. So that goes back to the 70s. And as we move forward, we were introduced to a person who became our first director, outside director, mm-hmm. from Washington, D.C. And guess what his name was? James Freeze.
Well, I'm sorry, what?
His name was James Freeze. This was the guy who authorized the surveillance of all Americans for the first time, a brigadier general.
Okay.
And he became number three in the NSA. This was when he was running the U.S. Army Signals Intelligence mm-hmm. Group, which was at that point separated from the NSA, but they were all working together.
Mm-hmm.
And it was closely tied with the British. So one of the things I think I would suggest everyone start doing is start thinking of intelligence in a larger context. And the CIA is not running the show. They are one of the implementers.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is the British Pilgrim Society, through the three-letter agencies in Britain, are running American intelligence.
Right.
And have been for at least since 1946, and actually before that.
Yes. I do know that they were involved in the 1917 or 1916, when I think it was either Canada or America, wherever Lenin. Lenin was in captivity over here in North America, and the call for his release actually came out of the UK because they needed him to actually help finalize or actually successfully close out this Bolshevik revolution. They just didn't have a strong leader, and they said they really need a strong leader, and Lenin is the guy. And so he was basically and this actually came out of a book. I think I mentioned A. Ralph Epperson in the past with you, but he talks about how this was all coordinated, just like with Mao. again, the UK basically says, hey, you, America, because we were at the, I think Congress had voted to provide some financial assistance to the emperor or whatever that was in charge of China at the time during their Bolshevik revolution or during their communist revolution. And it was the UK that basically says, stop, don't send that money. We need to let this happen. And that's what happened.
Well, I'm not familiar with the work you cite, but we have actually done a lot of work on Lenin.
Yeah.
And the fact is, his association with the British goes back to 1902, when the Pilgrim Society, the newly formed Pilgrim Society in London, started hosting him and training him to become a Bolshevik in 1902. And he made five different trips to England, and he was hosted by the Pilgrim Society, and they were the one that pretty much were his handlers on how the Bolshevik Revolution happened. And then eventually he moved to Zurich, Switzerland, where the famous story of him getting on a train in Zurich and traveling to Moscow through a sealed train through Germany. He was able to get through Germany and went to Leningrad, and that really began the Bolshevik Revolution. So I'm not familiar with him ever coming to the U.S., but the fact is that the British were working very diligently before World War I to make sure that they dethroned the Tsar and were able to take control of Russian resources through the Bolsheviks. And then there's another story about Mao, where Mao was basically trained through the YMCA in China, and that was a British creation. And he was his early days were sponsored by the YMCA, i.e. British, and that's how he came to power. So what we see here is a if you think about the British East India Company and its modern version, which is basically the Pilgrim Society, these guys were very bent on making sure that the banking and commercial competition that they were getting from Russia and China and anywhere else in the world, America, was under their control. And so if you look at the larger picture of what's going on today, all roads lead back to banking and commerce. And it really comes out of the British desire to continue to control the world as the world modernized around the turn of the last century.
Okay, so I will concede that I'm not a subject matter expert. I'm trying to recall out of the unseen hand that Britain was somewhat involved in the process of getting Lenin into the USSR, or I should say Russia.
He was, but he never came to the States.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Fair enough. The other thing I wanted to dive into, because you talk about the Pilgrim Society. When did that actually form? Was that formed?
July of 1902.
1902. So
yes.
There have been other activities that I, can account for, because Britain had been very involved in America since, as a matter of fact, since the colonies and after Britain became this world power, they had been manipulating the world, and the West Indies and the East Indies, these trading companies were very nefarious, doing really evil stuff for them.
Right.
But and they were doing all the dirty work. Here the king always, or the monarchy always seemed like they were just beyond reproach. And they were constantly manipulating things like what they did in America by mandating slavery be blacks only. And so when King George did that in the 1600s, basically it forced America to have to deal with a problem that it still kind of plagues us to this day. But nevertheless, I mean, they were doing manipulation with the Indians. They were creating treaties that were actually problematic for the colonists. And
well,
so,
can I comment on that?
Yeah, go ahead.
In addition to the blacks, basically slavery was a basic tenet of the merchants with the sword, the British East India Company.
Uh-huh.
And they really didn't care who they enslaved. So, yes, they were enslaving blacks from Africa, but they were also enslaving Creoles in the Caribbean. They were enslaving Irish. They were enslaving Chinese. And it was all about the money. It was all about controlling human creativity of any kind through their bankers. And if we look at the origins of this British penchant for control, we have to go back to the formation of the City of London, which occurred in 1067. And that was within months of William the Conqueror from France coming in and taking over the monarchy in England. And one of his first acts was to form the City of London in a charter, which we still have today. And in that charter, he identified that the membership in the City of London was going to be all men, and it was going to be passed down to the sons, and it would be run out of what is London now, but at that time was not it was a seafaring port, but was not the center of government. So that all happened after that. So once they started taking over commerce on the seas, replacing the old Silk Road land routes across from China all the way to England, they have never stopped working to dominate the world in economics and banking. And
right.
So that's really where that started.
Okay. And that right there is, I think, another good dive, because we can go back in finance and banking and how they created, I don't want to say a gold standard, but they actually created a standard in banking and banking principles before even this country was established.
Yeah, before. Well, if you look at banking as a topic, we have to take it back to Hammurabi in the Babylonians.
Okay.
They were the ones that said charging of interest was legitimate and to charge interest, even though the Hebrew prophets were railing against charging of interest.
Usury,
because
right.
Because they said it engaged people in slavery.
Right.
They were doing that. And so once the Babylonians learned how to do money creation and the charging of interest, they dominated the entire known world all the way from China to England. And that group of people, from our research, is still very much alive and dominating today. And they're called, an Arab geographer in 800 AD identified their name, called them the Babylonian Radonites. And these were people from an area of Babylon called Radon, which was a very exclusive residential area in Babylon that was the termination of the Silk Road coming out of China. And this group of Radonites claimed that they were Jewish. But they weren't, and they learned long ago that claiming to be Jewish helped them in business, and so they've been doing that for over 4,000 years. And so they were already in England at the time, at the formation of England. They had, if you look in the Book of Domes, which is the first book of the assets of England that was created after William the Conqueror took over England, they actually identify these people in the Book of Domes, and they're called Radonites. They didn't even change the name, R-A-D, Knights.
Uh-huh.
And that looks to be when knighthoods were begun in England. But they were just an extension of this old Babylonian trading network that had been going on for centuries, or not centuries, millennia.
Right, right. Okay.
And so consequently, These people learned banking well. They learned about slavery. They learned about child sacrifice because they were pagans. They were not Christians,
right.
Jews, or Muslims.
Right.
They worshipped Moloch. They worshipped Mammon, Lilith, Beelzebub, Baal.
They
were pagans.
Yes.
And they did child sacrifice.
And
they still do it.
So when Britain actually started going down this path of trying to control from the, what is that, the 11th century?
From the, 1067.
Right. So from the 11th century going down this path, at that point in time, there were so many different currencies. As a matter of fact, most currencies were commodities. Like in America,
yes.
The cash currency was tobacco. There's no doubt in my mind because Britain was at that point in time a mercantile system. So they had developed the ability to utilize all of these different, what we would call currencies, what they used as currencies back in those days, because not everybody had that much gold. And so as a matter of fact, when you read, you know, the ratification debates, you'll find that gold and silver was not very plentiful in America. And as a matter of fact, I believe it was Hamilton's Treasury Act of 1790, maybe it was 1792 or whenever it was the first act where they started minting gold, and they basically created a free service that you could bring in gold and they would give you in exchange actual coins, gold coins, silver coins, and so forth. And I think he included copper, but My point is that America, it was difficult for America to get started onto a metal currency in the very beginning because most of that specie had been taken.
Well, and most of our business was founded on loans from the City of London. And so we were heavily in debt at the time of the Revolution.
Right.
To British. And that was John Adams' big chagrin at the Treaty of Paris because we agreed to let those notes continue after the Revolution. And so that was the lock that the British were looking for, how they would continue to maintain control in America through controlling our finance.
Yeah.
Issuance of currency and the different standards, silver and gold standard. That occurred after that.
Right. And so what ended up happening is, and we had this conversation, that after the Revolutionary War and after that treaty, we basically exiled all of the British supporters and took all their property. And so in that process, and so the other thing was that at that point in time, Continental Congress was on the hook and none of the states were paying their war debt.
Well, the issue of the property, we told them they had to divest of their property, but we paid them for it. So we didn't take any of their property, but we were told, we told them they had to get out. They had 1 year to liquidate their assets and get out. So that way, in that year, there was a lot of shenanigans with the banking under Alexander Hamilton that allowed them to convert a lot of their debt into new forms of currency in the U.S. where they didn't actually divest. That's the dark secret of that whole period.
Yeah, so are you talking about when Hamilton? So when Hamilton was in the Treasury, because the exodus of the British, the Loyalists, that actually happened in, I think, 1783-84 timeframe before the Treasury existed.
Yeah, but the issue there was that Hamilton was a Loyalist. And he formed the first four banks as the first Treasury Secretary under Washington. And to get those banks financed, he went back and got mainly British and some Dutch money to finance those banks. And so what he started doing was giving favorable interest loans to Loyalists that were still there. And to the point where, as we've talked about, that was the reason the Republican Party was created, because the Republicans, the Loyalists, not the Loyalists, but the Patriots, American Revolution Patriots, were being denied loans because these British banks basically fronted the stock cash to start our first four banks, which are all still in operation today.
Yeah, so as I did a show on this, because clearly there is no enumerated power in the Constitution for the federal government to have a bank, to possess a bank, and to be able to make money via a bank. They have, as a matter of fact, they have no ability within the Constitution to become a money mill or the ability to do what they're doing. Their job is only to basically tax the states on what they need to do. Now, it's one thing to be able to create debt. And one of the things that Hamilton did, which basically forced, or I should say, it turned around and he created these exigencies after the Assumption Act by assuming that debt. Now, all of a sudden, they had this urgency because all the debtors were going to be coming and saying, hey, you owe us money. France being one of them, Holland and Britain being some critical ones as well. But the bottom line is that there was no authority. This is why Madison was just adamant, and that's why they realized what a double-cross treasonous creature. They actually used the word creature in their communications when they were talking about Hamilton.
Yeah, and he was a creature. Well, we have uncovered proof that Hamilton was a British spy.
Right. Yes,
and we discovered it in the Canadian archives that he was actually British spy number 7, and that his father-in-law, who was also a colonel in the Revolutionary Army, was British spy number 2. So Eliza's dad was a spy.
Yeah. So
as well as
and so my
Hamilton.
My point. I'm going back to my introduction. When it comes down to uncovering all of this stuff, as far as, you know, this history, you're probably the single repository or single reference point of having most all of these things to actually support the veracity of your claims. I mean, so that's why I just say,
well, that's been one of our, I'm a civil engineer by profession, by training. We like to work with facts. And so as we've done our research, one of our criteria was we had to be able to prove everything we're saying by hard facts, not speculation or surmise. And so you're right. Everything we've published, everything that I've talked about in specific detail, to the point where it's could be indictable evidence. In other words, it could be used in a court of law without any additional verification.
Yeah, but the problem is that we have no honesty in our courts, nor do we have justice. So that's another problem.
Yeah, I don't mean that from the standpoint of trying to file cases.
No, I completely understand what you're saying.
The standard,
you
the
bet.
Standard by which you put in evidence we've used.
Yeah, I just have to, I don't want to give the judges in our legal system a pass for, you know.
No, I don't either.
Okay. So now we, you know, kind of have covered this, and I've come up to this point where you actually have this huge file. Now, this is a repository of all your documents. Is that not correct or what?
Yes.
Okay. And how big is that? And that's a zip file, if I remember correctly. It's almost 200 gigs.
Yeah, I think it's about 260 gigabytes.
Oh, okay. Okay. And is that compressed or is that uncompressed at 260?
Compressed.
Okay. And uncompressed, it would become?
I don't know. I forgot to look.
Oh, okay. That's okay. But if I remember correctly, so what I'm asking now, if you can remember, to provide, you know, a link to where this is, and if I remember correctly, because I downloaded this, and I told you that earlier. Then I looked, and you said you mentioned on your website that you had some tools to use this. And
yes.
So is that an application that somebody would just have to download and execute on their system, or is it something that would be done via the web?
You could do it via the web. You just go to AmericansForInnovation.com and click on Research.
Okay.
And on that page, you can see the links to those documents, and there's a search tool in there so that those documents are all completely indexed so that you can search on any individual keyword in any file
okay.
in the system.
Okay. All right. So what I'd like to do, maybe in a future phone call, is actually kind of walk through some of this with some, you know, very specific things I'd like to drill into, maybe the Pilgrim Society and some of these other things, whatever the listeners, you know, come back and say, you know, hey, what about this? Other than the Pilgrim Society, what would you consider, and the banking, what else would you consider is something that is one of those best kept secrets that most people really need to know about?
Yeah, we, in doing our research, we started looking at when did modern intelligence begin, the spy business. And we discovered a particular event that occurred in Britain in 1909, and it was called the First Imperial Press Conference, 1909. And what we discovered in the organizing documents, first of all, there was almost nothing out on the web in any library that talked about this. There were a few vague references, but there was no meaty detail. And we stumbled across a book that was referenced that was published after this event occurred, but that all copies of it disappeared. You couldn't find a copy of it. And we discovered a reference to it in a particular university in the Midwest, and they said, "Oh, we can see it's there, but it's out in a box, and it's not cataloged, and it's off-site, and we only send a truck there every 2 weeks, and we'll see if we can get it." So, cut a long story short. About 6 weeks, 8 weeks later, they said, okay, we have the document, and so we got a copy of it. And it was a detailed catalog of this meeting in 1909 from June 5th to June 28th. Mm. And it was a gathering of newspaper men from all over the planet. And I say men specifically. There was only one woman in this entire event. And it was held in the city of London in an area called Shepherd's Bush, which is really famous today because that's where BBC TV Center is. Mm-hmm. And I actually organized some gospel music groups, and we sang at Shepherd's Bush at BBC's TV Center about 30 years ago. And anyway, they had this event. It was about 650 newspaper men from all over the planet, and they got together to talk about the use of wireless technology as they move forward to get a consistent message out throughout the world about the British Empire and their control, and to talk about subjects surrounding the idea of extending the reach of the British Empire through the media. And one of their chief spiritual organizers was a guy by the name of W.T. Stead, who is known to this day as the father of tabloid journalism. And he wrote a pamphlet that he was educating politicians on called Government by Journalism. And we have those documents. And what they were basically doing was figuring out a way that they could use their power of the press to control public opinion throughout the world, and of course reinforcing the messages of the British Empire going forward.
Right. So it was probably twofold, because it was also a good way of reporting raw intelligence.
Wow.
Yeah, so I actually started talking about FIBIS, and I'm sure you're familiar with FIBIS.
No.
Foreign Broadcasting Intelligence Service. It's an apparatus of the federal spying. Anyway, so I've kind of paused. Actually, I didn't pause, so let me go ahead and
I didn't hear that. Mine cut off while I was talking.
So what I was talking about, because we were so rudely interrupted by whatever technology is disconnecting us.
Right. So we'll pray for the guy who's doing that.
Yeah. So the press has been and is, and it's always been, a raw collector of raw intelligence that, you know, these are events that are happening. Now, there's always stuff that's behind the scenes, but the press system has been used because the federal government has this thing called FIBIS, Foreign Broadcast Intelligence Service, where, you know, you can get all of the news that's happening around the world through this system. I mean, it's all the headlines of any type of event that they consider, you know, intelligence worthy, you know, like not who won the blue ribbon on the pumpkin pie submission, or, you know, what pig, you know, won the in the World Fair. It's really very, very specific to the type of information that they have, you know, that is being brought in. And it seems to me like this conference probably was a catalyst for this. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't done with my story because I'm sorry. There's another aspect of this that is shocking.
Okay.
And that is, as soon as this event was over, on June 28th, two things happened. One, this event agreed to have certain people stay behind and start the Empire Press Union, which was basically what you're talking about there, FIBIS, but it was for the entire British Empire. And it was actually Reuters and AP.
Ah, okay. Which is prevalent in America today, yeah.
Yes. And then the next thing that happened within weeks, the Prime Minister at the time, Asquith, went before Parliament and he got authorization to start the modern British intelligence system, MI6, MI5, and what is now GCHQ.
So let me ask you this.
The British equivalent of FBI, CIA, NSA.
Okay, so...
Okay, it gets even more nefarious.
Right. So I get that.
He got those. He formed those organizations, and then he specifically says in the parliamentary record, which we have obtained, that he was recruiting the agents for those intelligence agents from the newspaper men that were there for the Imperial Press Conference. So the spy business did not start propaganda. The propaganda business started the spy business.
Okay.
That's the shocker.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, because obviously when we look at the manipulation from the crown over several centuries of time since they became the world empire, and as a matter of fact, the way they manipulated China over opium and so forth,
yes.
It was always about manipulation. And so I could see that. But here's the question I have. Are you telling me today that Reuters and AP are still British owned?
Yes.
So in other words, if we have a system that is reporting raw information like our elections, before it gets to anybody else, it goes to them.
Yes.
What we're really doing is we're directing our, you know, this important election, very, you know, it's not supposed to be involved in a foreign entity. We're actually sharing this with a foreign entity.
Well, they're running it.
I understand that. I understand that. But one of the things that's been uncovered is the fact that these systems that Dell was brought, you know, as Dell was accumulating the data of the election, supposedly the outcomes with their algorithms making modifications to it from the software that maybe was running on the Dell. But either way, Dell was, you know, constantly updating and sending information, if I remember correctly, to either Reuters or AP. I forget which. But that was going before it even went to any state or news, you know, local or national news agency.
Well, Dell was a technology player in the larger picture, which is driven out of Fleet Street in London by members of the British Pilgrim Society, one of which is Lord Mark Malik Brown, who is the chairman of Dominion Voting Systems. or was chairman, and he was also the chairman of Smartmatic.
Yeah.
And Dominion and Smartmatic are two of our election machines.
Okay, interesting. So
in addition to that, he formed a piece of software called Optech, which is a scanning software that our Department of Justice essentially ordered it to be embedded in all of the vendors of election machines in this country. It's called Optech.
Okay, so where did this direction come from?
It was created by Mark Malik Brown out of Venezuela.
Okay, so out of Venezuela, but who was the driver for basically bridging these external entities, you know, like Dominion and so forth? Who was the, I'll just say, the operative that made sure that this got implemented at the state level?
The Pilgrim Society in London.
The Pilgrim Society of London, and they were basically, correct me if I'm wrong, they were basically directing our federal government to make sure this
yes.
was happening. No, because,
exactly.
Okay, so let me kind of peel back a little bit, because I'm not sure if you got a chance to see my petitions that we have already. Not mine, our petitions. And there's a team of people that are working working on a petition for election integrity. And the bottom line is the federal government has no authority whatsoever to be involved in any election. They do have
right.
a responsibility, because right there in the House and the Senate, they are to verify the outcome of their elections to ensure that the people that are to be seated were rightfully chosen. So that's why in 1811, there was a case, and we can dive into this later, but there was a case where a person was being seated and actually was seated as a member of the House of Representatives out of Virginia who was not actually elected. And so the challenger that actually won the election petitioned Congress to say, hey, that guy was not proper, you know, he was actually not elected. And they had to do the due diligence and go check, and they basically audited the election, and they unseated the guy, and they actually seated this other guy because they have that responsibility. But that's it. They do not have any involvement in how states function. And so this election integrity petition is basically to uncover and show that the federal government has been managing and orchestrating our overall election system. And it sounds like you have, you know, all of the goods here, as far as documentation and everything else that they could actually use in this, which is, I'll just say it's providential.
Yeah.
Because
they've injected themselves into the state operations by something called the Election Assurance Commission. And that is ostensibly the group that is verifying that the electronic election machines are operating properly.
Right, right.
So, like, we need it. We don't need that, because
no.
we need to go back to paper ballots.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, I agree.
What they did is they injected themselves into the process, and so states gave up the even – as bad as election machines are, they gave up any analysis of the election machines on a local basis
right.
by giving it all over to this Election Assurance Commission that does nothing more than rubber stamp
right.
all of these pieces of equipment, which do include a lot of Dell equipment.
Right.
But it's not just Dell. It's
no,
Cisco and everybody else.
Sure, yeah. Oh, yeah, I've heard about all that. Okay, so I probably, you know, I don't want to put you in a pinch by asking you this. And if you'd say, let's talk about this off the air, that's fine, because I am recording this. Who would be the appropriate person? Because like I said, if you haven't seen some of these petitions, we got one on the medical freedom, or, you know, Obamacare and all this unconstitutional tyranny. The same thing with the legislative authority that the court has, you know, assumed and has been basically reigning tyranny from the bench, the invasion. So we have, you know, right now about 10 petitions. There's a team that's assembling to do one on the election, and I'd like to actually get them so that they could, because you have the repository. This would really help
yes.
them with this petition. And so when you look at these petitions, these are irrefutable constitutional arguments that what is happening, you know, the federal government's involvement, you know, is absolutely a violation of the Constitution. And right now, as we're heading into the next critical election, that there is no chance of being able to do it any other way than printing and doing it the old-fashioned in-person precinct voting, period. Because there's nobody that can actually come up with a clean system, especially what it takes to do that. And more importantly, the fact that I recognize that there was a real problem a long time ago when all of the states started using the same systems, and this was back in the early 2000s.
Right. Well, we've tried to bottom line. I'm an engineer, you know, I like the bottom line thing.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And we bottom lined this principle to the issue of chain of custody, and that is a guiding principle for anything we do with elections. And the fact is, there's nothing, you can't prove chain of custody with anything with software.
Yeah, and so chain of custody is also a legal evidence factor.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's a hard, good principle. And so what we've said is the issue is chain of custody. We've got to have bipartisan, unbroken chain of custody. And if you can't prove that, your system isn't constitutional.
Okay. So let me ask you this. You probably haven't had any time to look at any of the stuff that I have on Reclaiming the Republic.
No, I'm sorry, I haven't
That's
been
okay.
able to, because we just met.
Yeah. That's okay. Yeah, seriously, folks, we just had a conversation on Friday, and on Monday we're recording, so something like that. So
yes.
What I want to do is I'm going to send you my color-coded Constitution. So what I've gone through painstakingly when I read the Constitution on the air and I say, this is being violated, this is how, we highlight it and say, this is really an egregious violation. So we have a lot of different violations in the Constitution that we've highlighted. Then we have all of these other powers that we kind of have an easy path on unconstitutional powers because of the three presidential vetoes of the Department of Transportation. We can get into that later. But what I'd like to do is, I mean, sometimes it's easier to just say, hey, you know what you've got, and you could probably easily come along and really help us with the reference material for some of these types of petitions. Like one petition that we're doing right now is the fact that the federal government is authorizing and allowing foreign entities to possess American resources. That's
right.
A clear violation of the Constitution. Their job
right.
is to protect our sovereignty, not to sell us out. And no state, right there in the Constitution, no state can make a contract or even allow something to be transferred to a foreign entity.
Right.
It's exactly. called the Compact Clause. And so,
well, I thought you were going to ask me a different question.
Oh, no. So I'm just saying that this is one thing that I think you could easily help with. As you look through these highlights, you can probably go, and what it does is it begs us to have a conversation of how we can create these petitions. I already know we've got hundreds of petitions to do. We've got 10 with one coming on the way. And so this hopefully will create, I think, a rich opportunity for all of us to be able to make real headway in creating the kickstart of, we want to get to 95 theses.
Yes.
And we've talked to this. Go ahead.
That's been one of my frustrations with reading about all these lawsuits that occurred after the last election.
Right.
And one of the things that I think is pretty obvious now is that the lawyers that got involved did not do their homework.
No, I don't think that they cared. They only cared about making money because they didn't care about the outcome. And so
yeah.
we've got and less than
we had published a lot of this information
uh-huh.
back then.
Okay.
And
they
didn't use any of it.
We got 1 minute left. And so I really.
Okay. Well, let me
go ahead. So, folks, this is the third time we've been cut off. I'm using a voice over IP, and he's using a landline. And so, unfortunately, we're not able to, actually close out with his, closing comments. So let me just kind of wrap it up. we're going to bring Mike back. We're going to be talking to him, and we're going to be basically looking at what he can kind of bring to the table as we, you know, as we march forward in creating petitions, because there's no doubt in my mind he can just overwhelm us with all of the evidence and all of the data that we can use and we need to use regarding, you know, these petitions and get many of these petitions done. In other words, we're going to make it easier for you. If you really want to help and write petitions and learn how to do this, just pick up the petitions off of our petition page. Start reading through them so you can kind of see how we formed them. We will help you. We're here to help. And oh, as I always say, you know, as G.R. Mobley, I'm always here to help and I'm not from the government. And so we'll have Mike back again. Mike, sorry, we just had a minute left and we ended up getting disconnected. So, folks, we are creating a way back in reclaiming this republic, and we need your help. Thank you so much, and God bless.